It's 12:37. Let's take a look now at the weather. The severe thunderstorm warning for northeastern Douglas and southeastern Champaign counties has been canceled by the National Weather Service office at Lincoln, Illinois. The storm, which prompted the warning, has moved out of the warned area. However, in the WILL severe weather coverage area, the warning remains in effect until 1 o'clock for southern Vermilion County in Illinois. At 12:30, National Weather Service meteorologists detected a severe thunderstorm capable of producing quarter-size hail and destructive winds in excess of 70 miles per hour. The storm was located near Sidel, or 19 miles southwest of Danville, moving northeast at 55 miles per hour. Meanwhile, a tornado watch remains in effect until 1 o'clock this afternoon for all of the counties within the WILL severe weather coverage area: Champaign, Coles, DeWitt, Douglas, Ford, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, and Vermilion. A powerful spring storm system is lifting northeast out of the plains. It will spread strong to severe thunderstorms across parts of the Midwest today. The highest probability of severe storms will be this afternoon and evening from central Illinois southward into the mid-Mississippi Valley. Damaging winds, large hail, and tornadoes will be possible this afternoon and evening. After the severe storms push through tonight, more rain with embedded thunderstorms are possible into tomorrow as low pressure tracks across the area. High temperatures in the region today will range from the mid-50s north to the 80s south. Lows overnight will range from the upper 40s west to the mid-60s in the southeast. Let's take a look at the forecast now for east central Illinois. Again, that tornado watch remains in effect until 1 o'clock this afternoon, and we do expect that a new watch will be issued at some point later this afternoon. This afternoon, breezy with widespread showers and thunderstorms. Some storms may be severe. Locally, heavy rainfall is possible. The high 83. The wind will be out of the south at 20 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms. Some of the storms may be severe this evening. Locally, heavy rainfall is possible this evening. The low 62. The wind from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers are likely and there's a chance of thunderstorms. It will be cooler tomorrow. The high 68. The wind out of the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, cloudy and cool with a chance of showers. The low 48. The wind out of the north at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday, mostly cloudy with a high of 65. The wind will be out of the north early. In the afternoon, it will shift and be out of the southwest. Friday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight. We'll see a low in the mid-50s. Saturday and Saturday night, mostly cloudy and warmer with a high in the upper 70s and a low in the low 60s. Temperatures across Illinois and Indiana at noon central time ranged from the low 60s to the low 80s, where 80s were reported. We had sunshine, and where the lower temperatures were reported, it was raining. In Rockford, or cloudy, in Rockford it was 62 degrees, at O'Hare 58. Bloomington checked in with 67, 72 in Springfield. Mattoon reported 66 degrees, and Carbondale 81. At South Bend, 62, Lafayette 73, Indianapolis, and Evansville reported 83 degrees at the top of the hour. Willard Airport reported a thunderstorm at noon, with a temperature of 63, the dew point 61, the relative humidity 93%, the wind out of the north at 6 miles per hour, the barometric pressure 29.67, and steady. And at 12:41, 64 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The countdown clock is ticking for Democratic lawmakers in the state capitol. In less than a week, they need to roll out a final draft of a legislative map or reluctantly hand off some power to the Republican minority. At the most recent hearing on the proposed map, the feedback followed a general theme: go back to the drawing board. As Luke Runyon reports, Democrats may want to heed that advice or feed the fire of an almost certain court battle.
The map has been a solely Democratic project for months, given the party's rule over state government. And almost everyone has a stake in the new boundaries: minority groups, local governments, and perhaps the most powerful lobbyists of all, lawmakers themselves. The ruling Democrats have released their initial plan to very little fanfare and a whole lot of criticism. Much of it's coming from one of the fastest-growing voting blocs in Illinois, Latinos. Their numbers grew dramatically in the past decade, outpacing any other minority group and slipping past African Americans as the second-largest ethnic group in the state. They say the map should reflect that change, and representation in the state legislature should match up with the migration. But the main groups are split on the new map. Here's one side from attorney Nina Perales, who says districts around Chicago aren't up to par. She says the lines crisscross Latino neighborhoods and the map
packs and fractures Latino population across the South Side districts in a way that is dilutive and denies Latinos an opportunity to elect their candidates of choice.
Perales is with the legal powerhouse MALDEF, that's the Mexican-American Legal and Education Defense Fund. The group's team of lawyers and cash reserve for court cases make them the most likely to challenge a map they don't find suitable. They've been at the forefront of a number of high-profile cases across the country and are no stranger to lawsuits, especially concerning redistricting. Another Chicago-based Latino group, the United Neighborhood Organization, seems to be the only coalition completely pleased with the new map. Here's that group's CEO, Juan Rangel.
We are concerned with advancing the interests of the Latino community. We recognize and accept that the Illinois legislature must strike a balance with other minority groups' interests, particularly the African American community.
That's the biggest reason Democrats give when questioned about the modest gains in Latino districts. Federal and state law protects minority groups from being split up, but that makes drawing a map in incredibly diverse areas a challenge. House Democrat Barbara Flynn Curry is leading her chamber's remap effort. She says she's open to changes, but with caution. She says any line shifting could mean a further disadvantage to adjacent Black communities.
The map that we have gives effective opportunity for full political participation to the Latino community as a proportion of their share of the population without undercutting that same opportunity for effective participation in the African American community. MALDEF disagreed.
MALDEF is not alone in its criticism. Asian American groups, along with Arab and Indian organizations, say the map is lacking. They're also demanding Democrats tweak the map to make sure their neighborhoods stay intact as well. But a map can only do so much. History professor Alan Lichtman from American University signed off on the Democratic map's minority districts, the same task he had 10 years ago in the last remap. He's their paid expert consultant, but sums up the map's ultimate effect on the state legislature.
There's no guarantee in politics. All you can do in setting up a redistricting plan, which is why I always use these words and have used them for decades, is create reasonable opportunities for minority voters to elect candidates of their choice. You can't guarantee political outcomes.
Even with that uncertainty, it's clear Republicans will face an uphill climb, at least in the next election. They're facing a map drawn to ensure Democratic wins. But all this last-minute wrangling may be for naught. This proposed map is likely to change to accommodate some minority groups' demands, and possibly to help out a specific incumbent. Given their majorities in the House and Senate, Democrats are poised to pass a map and send it to the governor. Pat Quinn has indicated his main concern is that the map is fair. But that's a word with plenty of definitions when it comes to redistricting. I'm Luke Runyon.
Table saws are the country's most dangerous, commonly used power tool. 40,000 Americans end up in emergency rooms every year with injuries. According to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, 4,000 of them suffer amputations. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
A table saw has an open spinning blade the size of a dinner plate. And every day in this country, on average, more than 10 people cut off their fingers or even half of their hands on these saws. Carpenters lose their livelihoods. Many people never recover. But what's most striking is that all of those accidents are preventable. They don't have to happen.
The problem is enormous, and it's getting worse.
Sally Greenberg heads up the National Consumers League. The problem, she explains, is that there's a safety brake technology that can stop a table saw instantly before it cuts off a finger. It's like an airbag in a car. It's a breakthrough safety feature. But only one saw manufacturer builds it into its saws.
We've got this great technology. It's not terribly expensive to implement. Let's do it.
The technology is called SawStop. And its inventor, Steve Gass, likes to show how it works by using a hot dog.
I'm going to put this hot dog on top of the board here as if it was my thumb misplaced in the path of the blade. And then I'm going to shove it into the blade and all.
NPR has followed Steve Gass over the years as he started a company that is now manufacturing tens of thousands of these safe SawStop saws. Last summer, he was demonstrating his saw to a high school shop class. As soon as the hot dog touches the blade slams to a stop. The hot dog barely has a scratch on it. Actually, Sally Greenberg, the consumer advocate, she first heard about this safety issue on NPR 7 years ago, and she grew frustrated that after all of these years, the industry still hasn't adopted this technology and the government hasn't mandated it.
What we have here is a classic example of why the Consumer Product Safety Commission was set up by Congress. You have a pattern of injury. You have technology that can address the injury, and it can address the injury for a reasonable cost. This should have been done years ago.
So now, Greenberg's been meeting this week with government safety officials and members of Congress. She's visiting their offices with people who've suffered unnecessary injuries on table saws.
Reaching across the blade, my elbow entered the blade, and it proceeded to pull my arm all the way through the blade, cutting 100% through the ulna bone, tendons, ligaments, nerves.
Adam Thull is a professional carpenter who ran his own business. He's got a wife and kids and lives in Cross Lake, Minnesota. Since his accident a year ago, he's had multiple operations, but he remains in a lot of pain and can't earn a living.
Financially, we went from me and my wife actually having a successful small little business there to now we are on food stamps, medical assistance, energy assistance.
I want to be part of the solution.
That's Inez Tenenbaum, the chairman of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. She met with Thull and other injured people yesterday. Tenenbaum says she would prefer it if the industry would adopt this safety break technology voluntarily. But that clearly has not been happening. And she says she wants to push ahead with tougher safety regulations.
I do believe that we have enough votes here at the commission now to begin federal rulemaking. We could do this in the next few months.
For its part, the power tool industry is opposed to this kind of new regulation. The saw break technology adds around $100 in cost to a saw. So for expensive saws, that's maybe not such a big deal. But for cheap $100 table saws, it could double the price of those saws. Also, the power tool companies say that SawStop wants too much money to